I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk about a serious health challenge. We're going to talk about human papillomavirus, or HPV. We're going to talk about what HPV is, who it affects, and what we can do about it. Joining me for the discussion will be two experienced medical professionals, Dr. Maggie Blythe, Indiana University Professor of Pediatrics and Clinical Gynecology, and Dr. Charlene Graves, a retired pediatrician and former Indiana State Department of Health Director of Immunization Services. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881. Email nolimits@wfyi.org. Facebook is No Limits. And Twitter is WFYI. Now, this news.
No Limits is made possible by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking about the public health push for the HPV vaccine. That's a lot of V's to get into one statement. And if you would like to join the conversation, you can do so by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. My guests are two experienced medical professionals, starting with Dr. Maggie Blythe, who is a professor of pediatrics and clinical gynecology at Indiana University, and Dr. Charlene Graves, who's a retired pediatrician and the former medical director of the Indiana State Department of Health's immunization program. Welcome both of you to the program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It is great to have both of you here. Well, let's start with something basic here. We probably ought to talk to people. Those of us who have adolescent daughters, I think, know what HPV is. But could you talk a little bit about what HPV is? And I'm not going to try to get through the Latin name again. I'll start with you, Charlene.
Human papillomavirus, much easier to say as HPV, is a virus that is the most common sexually transmitted infection. It is transmitted by skin-to-skin contact. It can be acquired even the first time somebody has sex, and that includes oral sex or vaginal sex or anal sex. So it is an issue that is a public health concern, being the most common sexually transmitted infection. And we know now that we have a vaccine that can prevent most of those infections. And so that is why we are very concerned, because our young people are not getting vaccinated with this vaccine to the extent that should be happening to treat it as a public health issue.
What are the symptoms of HPV? Why should people be concerned about this?
Well, unfortunately, there aren't any. And that's part of the nemesis of this infection is that young people don't realize that they've had contact with this virus until, honestly, it's too late. The most common infection we see in adolescents and young adults are genital warts. And so that contact happens very readily and often appears within 2 to 3 weeks after the contact of someone else who is infected. The really great part of this vaccine is there have been other countries, particularly Australia, that have a school-based vaccination program where they've had an uptake of vaccine of 80% by their young people, their young women, and now their young men. And they've seen an 85% reduction in genital warts. That's one part of the equation. The other bigger equation is it's a vaccine that prevents cancer. And that really is the message that we're hoping to get across to parents. And it's not just cervical cancer. Now there's a whole number of different cancers that we have found this virus related to.
And when you say that it prevents cancer, at what point should young people consider taking the vaccine? I mean, I know part of, and I'll speak as a father here, you know, when we first got the notification that this might be something that would be good to do, I'm thinking, you know, the fact that it is a preventative measure in terms of sexually transmitted diseases, I thought at my daughter, who was, you know, very young at the time and all of that, I thought, oh, she's mm-hmm. just my baby. I don't even want to think about this at this time. At what ages should you consider vaccinating? I'll stay with you, Maggie.
Yeah, it's a really good question. The actual recommendations by the advisory group on immunization practices really recommend that this vaccine be given on the 11 to 12-year-old age group. And that is a lot to discuss with parents because there are other vaccines that are recommended, what we call at that platform time where other vaccines are given. But the recommendations are there, and there's a couple different reasons. One, you want to give the vaccine before there's any potential of any sexual contact. Mm-hmm. And we know that, and statistically in this country, a third of teens have actually had vaginal intercourse by the time they are a freshman in high school. So we're talking about a very intimate contact, but there are other, as Charlene said, other sexual contacts that can happen where you have contact with that virus. And the other big reason that's been definitely supportive of giving it early is, at least titer-wise, we find, and this particular detail was noted when the original studies were done, the 9 to 15-year-old age group actually develops higher titers immunologically to this virus.
What are titers?
Titers, in other words, antibodies.
Okay,
so protective antibodies. So when you give it younger, they develop higher antibody titers than when you give it even 16 to 26 years of age. So, you know, so I think for a couple of those two major reasons that you want to give it young, you know, so that there's no decision making around it too late.
And presumably it's not something that works retroactively, Charlene.
No, the vaccine does not work retroactively. It is not a treatment for somebody that has already acquired the HPV infection. But it does prevent several of the strains of the most commonly acquired HPV. And so, again, it is a series of three injections that needs to be given over a six-month period of time. So, again, like Maggie just said, the 11 to 12-year-old is the ideal time to get that vaccination series started. We know that the immunity that's obtained from that, the protection against infection of a three-shot series is very, very strong and also has been found so far to last for at least 8 to 10 years. So it's providing protection into the future also.
So it sounds like, and I should inform our listeners, if you want to join the conversation, we're talking about HPV and the public push to vaccinate here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. It sounds like it's also not a one-and-done kind of thing,
exactly,
too, in that this vaccination is going to be part of, you know, a life commitment to maintaining health as well, Maggie.
Yeah, I think that's a really, again, a good question or good response. Obviously, we talk about starting the vaccine at the well child, the preventive health care visit at 11 to 12, but we really encourage physicians because young people come in for more than just the well child visit. So an example would be a young person who's coming in for a recheck of their acne. So you get that second vaccine for that recheck of acne, not wait a whole year to get that second vaccine. So it becomes incumbent on the staff, too, to remind parents, oh, geez, you know, you haven't gotten that second vaccine. It really is within that time frame. We'd like to go ahead and give it today as part of that completion of that series. On the other hand, if someone gets the first vaccine and doesn't reappear in the office for 6 months, you don't restart that vaccine over again. You actually just give the second one then. And actually what we try to do is have them in certainly within the next 4 months, you know, because the first and third one have to be at least 6 months apart. So the third vaccine is actually acting like a booster, you know. So the first two are really critical to get the antibody titers, and then that third one boosts the antibody titers so that they hopefully remain protective. They should.
Now, is there a danger, like, if you have that first shot and you go beyond the 6 months to have the second one? I mean, does it lose its effectiveness, or is there no
Charlene, you're shaking your head.
No, it does not. Yeah. It does not lose its effectiveness. Again, it's a nice thing about the flexibility of the recommended immunization schedule. Ideally, we'd like them to have the first dose, then the second dose either 1 or 2 months later, and then the third dose 6 months later. But in the real world, maybe that can't happen too easily. And thus, again, you just keep going from whenever you started, and it does not lose its effectiveness, no matter what time frame it ends up being given.
Now, what are our rates of vaccination in this state? I mean, it, obviously, the fact that we're doing a push leads me to presume that they're not high, that they're not where we would like them to be. Maggie, I'll...
Yeah, we're like 40th in all 50 states. And so, but we do very well. In fact, we're in the top five in terms of Tdap and meningococcal vaccines. So that point is that youth are getting to their doctor to get those vaccines that we consider sort of the 11 to 12-year-old platform. But for whatever reason, our rates of first vaccine in Indiana, one vaccine for young women is like 48%. The national rate's around 54%. For completion of series is like 35%. And that's for 13 to 17-year-olds when you survey them. So only a third of youth have actually completed the series, both at the national level as well as at the state level, of 13 to 17-year-olds.
And so, girls, that would be girls.
Yeah, it's much lower in boys.
Yes.
Obviously.
And in terms of the rate of success when there's a vaccination, I gather, you know, radio numbers don't make real compelling radio, so we're going to try to get rid of all of them here in one fell swoop. In terms of the rate of success when someone is vaccinated, how does that reduce the risk? I mean, what kind of guarantee, if you do the entire series of shots, do you have that you are not going to have HPV or confront it?
So if we're talking about cervical cancer, that's related to specifically type 16 and 18, the protection rate in this country is about 66%.
I've gotten an email question from a listener, and if you would like to join the conversation and send us an email, you can do so by sending it to nolimits@wfyi.org. It says, my daughter was one of the early ones to receive this vaccine. I cried with relief when the protocol was completed, grateful beyond words for the disease I just prevented for her. Mm-hmm. And that raises a question. I mean, how long have we had this in place?
The first vaccine for HPV was approved by the Food and Drug Administration in 2006. So here we are in 2014, so that's 8 years later.
It's a relatively recent phenomenon, then.
Well, compared to some vaccines, but again, it is important that teenagers in particular get vaccinated, as one of the points we're trying to emphasize.
And how are we doing the outreach to convince them that they need the vaccine?
I think it's important. You know, there's lots of barriers that have been discussed both in surveys as well as our family groups, parents particularly. To show what those barriers are. And our push is for families to certainly consider the vaccine in terms of its reliability, its safety factors, thinking about its, you know, you want to give it before exposure. I think the CDC has made a good point. For every other infectious disease for which we have vaccines, we don't wait until someone's exposed. Mm-hmm. What we do is we give it before exposure in hopes of preventing. And that's what this whole message is all about. It's a message of giving a vaccine before there's any exposure so that you can prevent something from happening in the future.
Is it hard to get past? I mean, the fact mm-hmm. that there is a link with it being sexually transmitted disease. You know, I mean, as I say, I when you're talking with my young, a young child about that, most parents are going to say, I really don't want to think about that. How do you break through that wall?
I think the biggest and the most compelling response is that this is a vaccine to prevent cancer. Mm-hmm. Yes, the vector is a sexually acquired infection, but the reality is it's to prevent cancer. And so for most parents, when you do surveys with them and talk to them, that is the most compelling reason that they indeed agree to go ahead and vaccinate their youth.
Because they see it as life-threatening.
And we also know that, again, the studies have been done to show that giving the vaccine and comparing it to girls who have not been vaccinated, the girls who have been vaccinated do not have sex sooner than the other girls, and also there's no increased pregnancies or anything else, no increased sexually transmitted infections for vaccinated girls.
We are talking about the public health push for the HPV vaccine here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Dr. Maggie Blythe, Professor of Pediatrics and Clinical Gynecology at Indiana University, and Dr. Charlene Graves, a retired pediatrician. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about the public health push for the HPV vaccine. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can do so by calling us at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Dr. Maggie Blythe and Dr. Charlene Graves. Susan, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Certainly. What's on your mind?
Well, I was diagnosed with HPV back when it was still kind of new in 2003. And one thing that I've been continually frustrated with is just being given inconsistent education by different licensed nurse practitioners and doctors. I've gone to school in different states, and so I've seen a lot of different medical specialists. And over my, over the time of having HPV, one thing I heard your doctor say was that if you have it, it's kind of too late for you. And I was actually told to get vaccinated still because I could still get other strains of it. And another thing that has been confusing for me is knowing when I'm putting a partner in danger of getting it. I've been told anytime I could transfer it to someone. I've also been told that if I've had a number of clear pap smears, I'm not shedding and therefore can't expose someone to it. So I just think there are medical professionals who still don't quite, aren't giving a consistent message to young people, and it's a little, scary kind of.
Thanks very much for the call, Susan.
You're welcome.
Maggie.
Yeah, so you have a number of questions in your question, and I'll do my best to answer them. First of all, the vaccine, the quadrivalent vaccine, protects against four different types, as Charlene mentioned, 16 and 18, which we consider the oncogenic strains. Those are the two strains that can be related to the progression or the clinical presence of cancer. 6 and 11 are what we call non-oncogenic strains, and those are the ones that can cause genital warts but do not have the capacity to progress to cancer. And I'm not sure which test you had with which person, because there are a number of HPV tests that are used in a clinical setting. Just to clear the air a little bit, though, right now the current guidelines are that the HPV test should not be used in 21 to 29-year-olds unless for some reason they have an abnormal pap that's called ascus. And then they'll do a reflex HPV just to see if it's a high risk, an oncogenic strain, or a low risk, a non-oncogenic strain. If it's a low risk, then no further tests need to be done. And if it's a high risk, then recommendations are for a 21 to 29-year-old is just to repeat the pap smear in a year. Because oftentimes, and this is where it's really important to understand, oftentimes HPV can be transmitted, but it doesn't progress to cause any clinical disease. So HPV is only important to to diagnose if it actually translates into a clinical some clinical pathology.
Well, and it sounds like I'm going to pursue this line of questioning just for a second, because I think obviously where it really concerns people is when it does become
clinical,
life-threatening, deadly. Mm-hmm. I'm going to move out of the medical terminology that's okay. How often does that occur? You mentioned that there are four different
HPV types.
Yeah.
That the vaccine protects again now,
that
as we said.
Yeah.
It doesn't protect against all cervical cancers. It's about 65% of cervical cancers that are protected by this vaccine.
Okay. So, and out of the different strains of
types
of, types of HPV, mm-hmm. how often does that progress to cancer?
Good question. The rates are thought to be about 1 to 2% of abnormal pap smears will progress, okay? And that's the other issue. This vaccine helps prevent against what we call precancers.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of women have to go through the procedure of what we call getting diagnosed with what we call low-grade SIL, which is the early stage of a precancer.
Mm-hmm.
And then they may progress to high-grade SIL. Both of those diagnoses require clinical procedures to be done to them. With the vaccine, it protects against even about a third to half of those clinical precancers.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just preventing cancers, but it's also preventing precancers where women have to undergo a number of procedures. Getting back to your question, there's about 11,400, I believe they were the last numbers, of new cervical cancers each year diagnosed in the United States. And about a third of those result in death each year in the United States.
So if you have a 65% success rate, I think, using this vaccination, that means potentially you can prevent about 7,200 of those cases and save, the math is getting tricky here, but somewhere around 3,000 lives every year.
Right,
yes.
And the recommendations, the suggestions are yes, that's exactly right. So the numbers have actually been generated looking at where we're vaccinating at a 30% rate right now. And so we're not preventing, that results in 1,400 new deaths every year at that rate.
We've gotten an email from a listener named Eric. If you want to join us by email, you can do so by sending it to nolimits@wfyi.org. Eric says, I believe that boys should be vaccinated as well to quell the spread of HPV. Is it the same series of vaccinations? Please comment. Thank you for doing this program, Charlene.
Yes, it is exactly the same vaccine and exactly the same series of vaccination, three doses to be given over a six-month period of time. It is recommended that all young boys, 11 to 12 years of age, receive the vaccine, the same as young girls. The vaccine can actually be given beginning at 9 years of age, if desired, to both boys and girls. Again, if boys are between ages 13 to 21 and they have not been vaccinated, it is recommended that they receive the three-dose series of HPV vaccine also. So the recommendation is there. That recommendation came out in 2009 for boys to be added on for vaccination. The girl recommendation started in 2006.
Why did we start first with, was it, I hesitate to say this, but was it sort of the old sexism that, when it comes to this, or was there a different reason?
Well, initially, the vaccine was really looked at for protection against cervical cancer. And honestly, it's been very difficult to do the research with young men because obviously they've had to look at a variety of different places externally on young men for the HPV virus. And so to prove that you can protect a young woman with protecting a young man has been difficult.
Mm-hmm.
But we know with a variety of other cancers recently that have been associated with HPV, not only oropharyngeal, penile, anal, we know it's not just protecting young women, but it's also protecting young men from
it's
their own cancers.
It's protecting people, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
gotten a Facebook question from a listener, and if you want to reach out to us on Facebook, you can do so at No Limits WFYI. Says, is HPV responsible for other cancers, oral cancers?
Yeah, there's been a whole host of research around this area right now. And as far as the number of cancers, oropharyngeal, it's approximately 2,000, I think, per year, most of them in young men. And the majority are associated with HPV type 16. And so there's, even though this vaccine wasn't FDA approved for specifically this type of cancer, since then other data has come out looking at those other types of cancers, and we now know that HPV 16 particularly is really very closely associated with those oropharyngeal.
We are talking about HPV vaccines here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 866-476-3881. Ross, welcome to the program.
Hi. How are you today?
Doing well. What's on your mind?
Well, I'm originally, actually, we live in Knoxville, Tennessee, and I was just passing through and heard the conversation. In about 07, when my daughter was, I guess, 11, I guess is when we got the initial recommendation that she received the HPV vaccination, which we agreed to do, and she received it. And previous statement, you've partially answered my question. I have a son who at the time was considerably under 10 years old. He's now 17. I can't say that our general practitioner ever made the recommendation that he should receive the vaccine. And you partially answered the question, which was that at this point he should still receive the vaccine. I guess my only question remaining is, you know, again, you partially answered the question, which was, I guess, the recommendation changed a few years ago to include young men as well, or youth boys. But is there any difference in the effect of receiving the vaccine at 17, 18 years old versus receiving it at 11 and 12? And I'll take the answer offline. Thank you.
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Ross. Travel safely. Maggie.
Thank you.
So it's a very good question. And you know, most of the data in young men has actually been done in a couple different areas. One, looking at immunologic titers, as we mentioned, in the 9 to 15-year-olds, but also around anal cancer prevention. And it's very effective in that arena. We know about 70 to 80% of anal cancers, and that's something that's difficult to even think about, are actually protected with this vaccine. On the other hand, there are other variety of cancers, as we've already talked about, the oral pharyngeal and penile cancers. More than half of them are associated with type 16. So getting back to your original question, at age 17 now, definitely the recommendations are to go ahead and vaccinate. You know, when they looked at the original data, if someone had been exposed as a 16 to 26-year-old to HPV type, they had only been exposed to one of them, not all four of them. And so, as previously mentioned, even though it may not help protect against the one they've been exposed to, there are three others in that HPV or quadrivalent vaccine for which it will offer help.
We've gotten a couple of email questions that are on similar themes. One from a listener named Jean, who says, what about the women who have died from the Gardasil vaccine? And then another one from another listener that wants to talk more broadly about adverse reactions or side effects.
Yeah. Again, a really good question. And as with any vaccine, when it first comes out, there's a whole host of concerns around safety. And there have been a number of places where the vaccine's been watched, if you will. On the VARS website, where any kind of side effect of the vaccine may be reported. And then, obviously, the manufacturer itself continues to watch. And to me, the most impressive report was around 2011, when the Institute of Medicine looked at all of the vaccines and looked at their potential adverse side effects and to see if there was any correlation. And they looked at, particularly for the HPV vaccine, they looked at 12 different possibilities. Eight of them were neurologic. And what they found, there was no correlation with a neurologic outcome and getting the vaccine. And they looked at Guillain-Barré. They looked at transverse myelitis. They looked at multiple sclerosis, and there was no correlation. That being said, syncope, or passing out, is still a real possibility with this vaccine for young women. And in fact, for young women, they're at the highest risk of passing out with any vaccine. That for whatever reason, they're felt to have a bit more vasovagal instability. And
Could you break that down a little?
Yeah, that means
sure
that
I'm
they're more sensitive to getting an injection.
Okay.
And so the recommendation is when you give an injection, particularly to young women, even more than young men, but particularly to young women, you should watch them for 15 minutes, you know, so that they don't, you know, see if they pass out. It's something they may pass out, but they'll come right around. And I've had young women do this in my office. And it's very frightening, you know, to parents. And so I'll just have them hang around. If they feel faint, you know, have them lay down because that often helps. Again, that's not a real common side effect, but the fact you have to give it three different times rather than just one time increases the likelihood of that occurring.
Are there, you know, we've established that it's not a, you know, a treatment. It's not an after-the-fact cure, as it were, for HPV. But are there certain people who should not take this vaccine for whatever reason? If there's, you know, some sort of reaction or exposure to the vaccine itself would be dangerous, is there a profile they should look at? Charlene?
This has been studied, and there's actually only two what we call in medicine contraindications to this vaccine. One is for Gardasil, if somebody is allergic to yeast, that would be a contraindication.
Okay.
There's another vaccine that is called Cervarix. It's not as comprehensive as Gardasil. For that vaccine, some of the preparations of it have latex. So if somebody has an anaphylactic reaction, that very serious reaction that could result in death to latex, they should not receive that vaccine.
Are there signs or symptoms after you've had any of the vaccines, the three shots that would provoke concern that you think, okay, you ought to bring them back in? Maggie?
Well, I think we always let patients and families know that there may that what's considered serious is the syncope, as we've already talked about, passing out. They can have some headache. They can even have some nausea, upset stomach. There's a potential of a low-grade fever in the first 72 hours. But those are basically the side effects that are considered serious. In other words, there's some what we call systemic potential side effect. But the report of those serious side effects has dramatically decreased in the last 4 years.
And there would be some question whether those are actually serious, to tell you the truth, because those symptoms are common with many different things.
We've gotten an email question from a listener named Christine. If you'd like to reach out to us by email, you can do so by sending your email to nolimits@wfyi.org. It's a two-part question. I'm going to deal with the first one because she says, is this typically covered by insurance? Maggie?
Yes.
Yes, okay. If it is not, if you don't have a plan that allows you, what is the cost? Do we have some idea of that?
You know, I honestly, particularly with this era of the Affordable Care Act, have not run into any insurances unless someone hasn't signed up for a plan yet where that is not covered. It's considered a preventative health care measure. And so preventative health care is one of the things, the golden tools that we have under the Affordable Care Act, however one feels about it, that it's prevention of a disease that almost universally, I've not run into any plan at this point that doesn't cover it.
Also, I might add that for Medicaid patients, there's a program for children who are what we call Vaccines for Children Eligible, the VFC program. It's a federal program that provides funding to states to get vaccines out into offices, public health and private offices. So if they are Medicaid eligible, they are VFC eligible, and they can receive any of the recommended vaccines, including HPV vaccine, without any charge for the vaccine, only a minimal charge for the cost of administering the vaccine.
And can I just add to that? It's been my experience that some families have found that because of the cost of the vaccine, I mean, whatever their copay, there's been a copay sometimes, they've gone to their public health department and they've been able to get it for a very nominal cost.
We are talking about the public health push for the HPV vaccine. My guests are Dr. Maggie Blythe and Dr. Charlene Graves. I am John Kroll. You are listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about the public health push for the HPV vaccine. My guests are Dr. Maggie Blythe and Dr. Charlene Graves. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can do so by calling us at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. I'm going to get to the second part of Christine's question here because it requires a little more thought and deliberation. It says, would the vaccine be effective after age 26? I'm 37. Would it be an effective option for me to get the vaccine at this point? Is there any other way to protect myself against the virus? Maggie.
Yeah, that's a really good question. And there were actually studies done by the two companies to look at that age group, and it was decided it was not cost-effective, actually, to recommend vaccinating over 26-year-olds. And to my knowledge, they're perhaps because I don't know of many physicians that would vaccinate over 26 because of medical liability. They're not covered because it's not FDA approved for over 26 years of age.
And I apologize to Christine. The computer screen, I jumped over the second part of your question. It's actually, do you think it's important to tell an 11-year-old girl what she is being vaccinated for or just give her the vaccination with no explanation the way we do with vaccines to younger children? That, I apologize, Christine, cursor played tricks on me.
Yeah, another great question. And so I think it's important that 11 to 12-year-olds be told this is a vaccine to help prevent cancer. That's all they really want to know. In fact, they don't even pay attention to that. It's been my experience at 11 to 12. They don't even want another vaccine, you know. So
they want to know, will it hurt?
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, how fast can you get this done and is it really necessary? You know, it becomes more a question I find in my 14 to 15-year-olds I'm caring for them. And then oftentimes they have a lot of conversation among themselves, certainly in classes, and then they become much more aware around HPV and the likelihood of catching that vaccine. And this just dovetails on what Charlene said. There have been studies to look at young women, if they get the vaccine, do they feel like they are less likely to have to engage in safe sexual practices? And the answer to that is no. They realize that there are certainly other STDs out there and that this is not the only type of HPV.
And this, yeah. We are talking about the HPV vaccine here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by giving us a buzz at 866-476-3881, or you can send an email to us at nolimits@wfyi.org, as this listener has. Says, I read that even if HPV test is negative, one can still have the virus. Is this true, and how likely common do your guests estimate this false negative is to occur? Maggie.
Yeah, again, I think it relates to what our original answer was, and that there are a number of HPV different tests out there. For women, it's predominantly associated with getting a pap smear. And so there's just been published this week, you know, the whole idea that getting an HPV test is more sensitive for detecting precancerous lesions than actually the pap smear. And we know that the pap smear is not totally the best in terms of the only way to look for precancerous lesions, but to certainly suggest that we replace the pap smear with only an HPV test is currently not recommended. So the other issue is when you get an HPV test, it looks for just high-risk HPV and it looks for low-risk HPV. It doesn't tell you what type of HPV that you might have. And so there, as we've already alluded to, there are other types of high-risk HPV that the vaccine doesn't cover for.
We are talking about the HPV vaccine here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by giving us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Chris, welcome to the program. Chris, are you there?
Hello?
Hello.
Hello?
Hi, Chris. What's on your mind? Oops. We seem to have lost Chris. Okay. We'll go to an email question from a listener named David. It says, can HPV be passed to a child during childbirth? Charlene, I'll let you go.
Well, yes, it's a very rare event, but in fact, as a baby passes through the birth canal, if the mother is infected, it could. It rarely happens. The result of that could sometimes be what we call, the medical name is respiratory papillomatosis, but it's really kind of growths in the throat of the baby that can cause respiratory problems, but it's extremely rare.
We've gotten another email from a listener who says, neither my wife nor I had sexual relations until we got married. We don't plan on having sex with anyone else outside our marriage. So you could say that we have successfully stuck to the plan of abstinence. There were a lot of reasons we each made this decision and lived our lives the way we did, but the main reason was our religious beliefs. Would there have been any benefit for either of us to have gotten this vaccine? We now have a daughter who is 5, and I hope and pray that she will follow the same path that we did. It seems like a safer solution to sexually transmitted diseases. I just bring this up because it seems like we take for granted that teens will have sex, but that wasn't the case with my wife and me.
I think, as you've already alluded to, it's a very, very individual decision and a very private decision. But we still have to look at the statistics that we have currently in the United States, that even though your daughter or a daughter would elect to not have any kind of sexual intercourse, the partner may or may not have followed that same decision-making. The other issue I think that we've also discussed is that HPV can be passed other ways than just actual intercourse. And so there are certainly external passing in terms of both oral as well as hand to private area has been also described.
We've gotten another email question from Melanie. It says, what happens if we vaccinate 9 to 11-year-old girls and they are still dating at 29 years old? 20 years later, will it wear off? An earlier caller, let me see if I can get this. It's exposed to HPV with apparently abnormal pap smears, wanted to know if, oh, okay, I see. Yeah, let's go with the first question. Will it wear off?
Yeah, and as I think Charlene said at the beginning of the program, what we have right now is a group of women that have been followed for now 8 to 10 years, and it shows so far that it has not worn off. The dedication of the companies around following those young women is continuing to make sure and to see if there's any need for a booster dose. At this point, 8 to 10 years out, there is not.
We are talking about the HPV vaccine here on No Limits. Chris, welcome back to the program.
Yeah, hi. I'm sorry I lost my cell signal just a few minutes ago. I was listening to the show, and it's a great show. I've got two daughters, both in their early 20s now, and my wife and I did struggle with the decision, but we had them both vaccinated on the advice of a family friend who's a physician at Raleigh. But my question was, I heard one of the doctors mention Guillain-Barré, or as I know it, Guillain-Barré, it's a polyneuropathy. Was I mistaken in that?
It's not associated with that particular disorder. So
Was I correct, though, that you did mention that?
I did mention that it's not associated with having that disease or that disorder. With a vaccine. So getting the vaccine does not make you more likely to get Guillain-Barré.
Okay. In what context were you referring to it? Because, again, I was on the phone and trying to listen to the show at the same time, and all I heard was Guillain-Barré.
Right. So I was mentioning that the Institute of Medicine published a report in 2011, and they looked at all of the vaccines and whether or not they had any correlation with any kind of specific events. For the HPV vaccine, they looked at thromboembolic events, but they also looked at 8 neurologic disorders, one of which was Guillain-Barré, and showed there was no correlation.
Okay. Are you familiar with the Guillain-Barré syndrome or disease?
Yeah.
Yes.
Thanks very much for... go ahead, Chris. One more question.
Am I to understand that if it's treated with IVIGs, it could take up to a year for that IV to regenerate the nerves?
I'm just saying that's another conversation, but this vaccine is okay. Not related to that disorder.
Okay, that's why. Okay, thank you for your time.
Thank Certainly. Thank you very much for the call, Chris. Take care. We also had an earlier caller wanted to know if she'd had an abnormal pap smear, if she should get vaccinated, as there are multiple strains and only some of which cause cancer. If you have been exposed and carry one strain, can you still get another? Maggie.
Well, the answer to the second part of the question is yes, you can get a different type of HPV. And the answer to the first part of the question is yes, you should be vaccinated because, again, this is a quadrivalent vaccine. It has four different types of HPV for which you get protected. And so it's very efficacious to go ahead and get the vaccine.
And then we've got a question from Twitter, and if you want to tweet us, you can do so at WFYI. Says, if precancerous cells are found on the cervix, is there anything a woman can do to reduce the risk of cancer developing? Mm-hmm. Maggie.
Yeah, it's another really good question because we know that particularly for young women, and we're talking about, even under 30 at this point, for all of the lesions except for high-grade lesions, the recommendations are actually just to follow because we know that the majority of these pap smears will revert to normal. And so what I suggest to young women are certainly, bottom line is to limit number of partnerships, the number of people that you're having sex with. If you're in one relationship, then be protective for each other and give yourself a period of time. There were actually studies done in the early part of looking at this vaccine to show that, meaning in terms of looking at the natural history of HPV, and it really did show that if you had high-risk HPV, the average time that it takes for your body to get rid of it on its own is around 8 to 10 months. But it can get rid of it. And, in fact, the majority of the infections you do.
We are talking about the HPV vaccine here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 866-476-3881. Paul, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hello. What's on your mind?
Great. I got you. Hey, the vaccine, is it possible that the vaccine could prevent any types of cancer? And people, men say 60 or women or at any age? And that's just my question. Should I get off and listen?
Yeah, probably. Thanks very much for the call, Paul. We're getting a little bit of feedback, so thanks much.
Thanks.
Charlene or Maggie?
Yeah. So what we have to look at is the average age at which these different cancers present. And for the older man, particularly the oropharyngeal cancers present over 50. And so if we were going to talk about a group of cancers that this vaccine would have the potential for preventing, it would be the oropharyngeal for men as well. And then we do talk about, even though the numbers aren't high for penile cancer or anal cancers, it definitely has the capacity to prevent over half of those type of cancers.
And a listener question says, if the body does rid itself of HPV, can it reappear later in life? Mm-hmm. Charlene, you're nodding your head emphatically here, so I'm going to go with you on that.
Well, yes, there's been studies done that it can reappear. Now, whether that, quote, is reappearing due to acquiring it from sexual contact later on or whether it can lay dormant and reactivate is kind of a question, mm-hmm. I think, that's still open to discussion. Maggie, would you want to comment on that?
No, I agree with it, particularly type 16. There's been some question of whether or not it can appear and then lay dormant and then reappear. So there's still ongoing debate on that.
We are talking about the HPV virus here. It says, even if you could choose your child's morality, What if they were raped and got HPV on top of physical and emotional trauma? That's a Twitter comment, I think, in response to the earlier caller. Is that yet another argument for in a dangerous world, Charlene?
Well, I would say that's another argument for vaccination, to try to prevent, again, acquiring any kind of infection related to rape or any other sexual contact. And so, again, vaccinating, again, at the early age, as we recommend, 11 to 12 years of age, the national recommendation, should, again, provide protection, and it provides protection against acquiring cancer from HPV later on in life.
We're going to try to sneak in one more call. Kevin, you're on the air. What's your question?
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call.
Certainly.
Well, I guess I'm troubled because within the health field, industry, profession, we have all these people saying that vaccines are safe and there's no correlation between vaccines and disorders. But if that's the case, then why do patients have to sign waivers to receive vaccines? Why is there still a federal vaccination compensation program? Why is there still a federal court program for people to take their cases to court? It's like, you know, we're being told one thing, they're safe, but then there's all these safeguards in place to protect the pharmaceutical industry. So I'll take my answer off the call. I'm just curious of how that's rationalized.
Okay, thanks very much for the call and the question, Kevin. Charlene, Maggie, either one of you?
Well, I would say that, again, there's a number of systems in place to monitor vaccines, and the Vaccine Compensation Fund was set up many years ago for that rare possibility that some really serious adverse event would take place. The government is doing everything it can to try to protect people, and the reason we have vaccinations and prevent so many infections that used to kill people 50 years ago is, again, the importance of vaccinations from a public health point of view. It prevents disease, prevents infections.
And then we've gotten a question from a listener named Holly who says, shouldn't women with precancerous cells stop smoking as this increases risk of cervical cancer? That's probably going to be the last question because we're tight on time. But
I totally agree. Yes, quitting smoking helps prevent a lot of different cancers and not just cervical cancer.
But it does prevent.
It's actually been shown, well, it doesn't prevent cervical cancer,
but it adds to the risk. Yeah. It increases the risk. Are there other kinds of behaviors, real quickly, that people ought to avoid? They see the exposure of cervical cancer.
Well, I mean, honestly, the number of partnerships that someone has, the number of unprotected sexual contacts that someone has. There's a variety of health issues there that you can try. But just in general, I mean, we go back to the old adage of trying to be healthy. You know, I mean, exercise in terms of keeping your weight, you know, obviously weight's been associated with some other types of cancers, not necessarily cervical cancer, but they're just trying to maintain a good, healthy balance in a lot of different avenues of life will help.
That will have to be the last word. I'd like to thank my guests, Dr. Maggie Blythe and Dr. Charlene Graves. I am John Kroll. You have been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Cedric Freeman. And Board Engineer, Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each week for No Limits, made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.